to bring freedom music to its fullest expression, and Arnett Coleman, and Albert Ayler, a Cecil Taylor. In the late 1950s, however, the chief challenge to Coltrane's preeminence as the leading saxophonist of his day came not from Coleman or Ayler, little known at the time, or even from Dolphy. The most pervasive alternative to his sheets of sound approach emanated, rather, from the heart of the jazz tradition, in the person of tenorist Sonny Rollins. More than any of these celebrated players, Rollins would play the lead role in defining the mainstream sound of the tenor during these transition years. While other saxophonists were exploring the limits of dissonance, free improv and extended forms, third-stream mergings with classical music, exotic instruments, nonettes and octets, and other expanded bands, Rollins stayed mostly focused on forging a classic solo style. Much of the history of Adolf Sax's invention found its way into Rollins's playing. One could hear the connections that tied him to the legacy of a Coleman Hawkins or a Don Byas and other vintage horn players, seamlessly blended with hypermodern elements drawn from the current scene. "I like to think there is a direct link between early jazz and jazz of any time," Rollins told interviewer Bob Blumenthal in 1982. "I like to think that jazz can be played in a way that you could hear the old as well as the new. At least, that's how I try to play." A celebration of improvisation lay at the core of his artistry and served as the organizing principle for his finest recordings and performances. At times, his zest for the spontaneous flow of musical ideas would lead Rollins to produce extravagant, unaccompanied sax musings. Here, his creativity could run freely, with everything mixing together, snippets from operatic arias, movie themes, hoary pop tunes, bebop licks, a Joycean stream of consciousness as viewed through the bell of a horn. These unpredictable excursions came to achieve quasi-mythic status. Indeed, many of Rollins's fans refused to acknowledge that any of his albums, even the best, matched what they had heard in person, especially when the tenorist was unfettered by a rhythm section. But extended a cappella inventions were only a small part of Rollins's broad musical vision. Few jazz players of his day could boast of a more extensive repertoire, one that featured the highs and lows of the popular song tradition with equal fervor. And not just the standard American tunes. Kurt Weill, Noel Coward, and other Old World composers were honored alongside Gershwin and Porter. These deferential bows to songs from afar coexisted with the oddities, moldy oldies, and novelty tunes that Rollins somehow transformed into jazz, such as "I'm an Old Cowhand," or "The Tennessee Waltz," or "Toot Toot Tootsie." The scope of his music continued to grow with the passing years. In the early 1980s, it spanned everything from Dolly Parton to Stevie Wonder, tweaking the sensibilities of jazz purists, and even occasionally unnerving his sidemen. But Rollins's own hearty compositions played an equally critical role in his success. These were usually simple blowing pieces, favored not for their sophistication or their experimental implications, but simply because they were inviting springboards for soloing. To this day, many of Rollins's tunes, St. Thomas, Pent Up House, Doxy, Sunny Moon for Two, Erigen, Olio, remain standard fare at jazz jam sessions for this very reason. Especially refreshing are the calypso-inflected pieces, etudes and foot-tapping and finger-snapping such as St. Thomas and Don't Stop the Carnival, which eventually became Rollins's trademarks. But even when Rollins tried his hand, uncharacteristically, at a longer form, as in his Freedom Suite, the performance still retained the feel and flow of a spontaneous jam. In an age when jazz was becoming increasingly self-conscious and wedded to various ideologies, Rollins showed that it was still possible to create great works simply by abandoning himself to the flow of the music, immersing himself in the magic of the moment. Yet one should not minimize the cerebral aspect of his work. In an oft-cited essay, Günther Schuller analyzed Rollins's style of improvisation, calling attention to the tenorist's skill in constructing solos through the manipulation of simple musical motifs. Rollins excelled in using these as thematic material, restating them, varying them, elaborating on them, a jazz equivalent of the development section in sonata form. Schuller's observation may have made the spontaneous flow of Rollins's creativity sound like the result of a pseudo-mathematical process, and Schuller glossed over the fact that a similar claim could be made for many earlier jazz artists. Is there a better example of thematic development than King Oliver's solo on Dippermouth Blues from 1923? Still, much truth lay at the heart of these observations. At a time when jazz solos were increasingly sounding like a discontinuous flow of scales and licks, Rollins built his improvisations the old-fashioned way, phrase by phrase. This gave them a solidity, a strength, much like a house built carefully, one brick at a time. Alongside these edifices, the work of other, lesser talents, like the fairy tale Piglet's house, seemed mere palaces of straw, losing their shape after the first huff and puff. Even so, Rollins's reaction to Schuller was equivocal. When I read that, I was sort of taken aback because I didn't know what I was doing, the tenorist later explained. It made me self-conscious about playing. It took me a while to get over that. This may well be construed as a disavowal of Schuller's thesis, but just as likely, it reveals how instinctive the whole process of thematic improvisation had become to Rollins. Perhaps no jazz musician has ever had a more intense upbringing in the heart of the jazz world than Sonny Rollins. Born in New York on September 9, 1930, Rollins was always surrounded by world-class players. While still in his teens and after only 2 years playing the sax, he spent idle hours rehearsing with Thelonious Monk. During his high school years, Rollins fronted a band with other like-minded youngsters, Jackie McLean, Art Taylor, and Kenny Drew. No typical student band, this. At age 18, he participated in the classic Bud Powell's Modernist session for Blue Note, a date that could be pegged as the birth of the hard bop style. Other early performances and recordings find him alongside Charlie Parker, Miles Davis, the Modern Jazz Quartet, J.J. Johnson, and many other stars of the post-war jazz scene. In the mid-1950s, he was a member of the Clifford Brown Max Roach Quintet, a unit that ranks, by any measure, among the most important working bands of the decade. Right before the breakup of that group, following trumpeter Brown's death, Rollins participated in another classic session, the Tenor Madness Date, where he matched wits with John Coltrane in a historic pairing. By the time Rollins began releasing his many classic recordings as a leader in the late 1950s, he could boast a curriculum vitae unsurpassed by any of his contemporaries in the jazz world. Flourishing in these settings would, one might think, dispel any self-doubts Rollins might have had. Yet they apparently had the opposite effect, leaving a permanent undercurrent of self-criticism and dissatisfaction below Rollins's calm exterior. Fans have grown familiar with his attitude. Few were surprised when Rollins decided not to release the recording of his celebrated 2007 Carnegie Hall concert, which, despite rave reviews, did not live up to his own expectations. This was simply the tenorist's standard modus operandi, as demonstrated over the course of a career clouded by retracings, temporary retirements, and disappearances from the scene for practice and self-assessment. A half-century before the next Carnegie Hall album, Schuller's essay had caused Rollins even greater anxiety as he tried to live up to its theoretical implications. Similarly, the advent of Ornette Coleman and free jazz helped to spur another period of introspection. However, Rollins's most famous sabbatical from the jazz scene, which lasted from August 1959 to November 1961, has taken on mythic proportions in the artist's biography. This period often found the famous jazz star strolling up and down the Williamsburg Bridge on many evenings, playing his horn for the astonished passersby. At the time of his departure, Rollins was at the peak of his fame. During the previous 4 years, he had put together a remarkable body of work. A series of tenacious trio and quartet recordings were at the core of his oeuvre. No tenorist has ever played better when accompanied simply by bass and drums, as Rollins's work from this period makes clear. Way Out West, featuring him with Ray Brown and Shelly Mann from March 1957, the seminal trio recordings from a November 1957 date at the Village Vanguard, and Freedom Suite with Oscar Pettiford and Max Roach from the following February. Among the quartet projects, Work Time from December 1955 stands out as a major statement, perhaps Rollins's finest to that point in his career. This was followed by the even more lauded Saxophone Colossus from June 1956 and The Sound of Sonny with pianist Sonny Clark made 1 year later. These efforts, as well as his various guest appearances with other artists, such as the aforementioned showdown with Coltrane, made it clear that Rollins ranked among the premier improvisers of his generation. Yet Rollins, as we have noted, was dissatisfied. He went into seclusion for over 2 years, practicing, refining his craft, reading, thinking. His return was eagerly anticipated by jazz fans, especially given the superheated atmosphere of the jazz world circa 1960. New sounds were in the air. At no time in the history of jazz music had the mandate to progress been felt so pervasively by the leading players. At times it seemed as if progressivism were the only aesthetic measure that really counted for many critics and some fans at this juncture in the music's evolution. Rollins felt these pressures, yet ultimately reacted with ambivalence. When he returned, Rollins may have been a changed man. During his sabbatical, he had become a Rosicrucian, studied philosophy, exercised, practiced. But his music was strikingly unchanged, disappointing those who felt that Rollins, like Coltrane and Coleman, would create a totally different sound. His comeback album, The Bridge, was a solid effort, but found Rollins again playing jazz standards with a fairly traditional combo. The main change here was the addition of guitarist Jim Hall, a subtle accompanist and inspired soloist, but hardly the new thing in jazz. Post-1960, Rollins's career tended to display tentative forays into the latest trend, followed inevitably by a return to more familiar ground. For a time, Rollins hired some musicians associated with Ornette Coleman, but never made the full plunge into freedom music. Later recordings found him flirting with jazz-rock fusion, but never assimilating it fully either. When interest in acoustic jazz increased in the 1970s, Rollins obliged by joining McCoy Tyner, Ron Carter, and Al Foster for a much-publicized concert tour and recording. But this, too, proved to be a passing phase. In general, latter-day Rollins's finest moments came in mainstream settings of this sort, where he was challenged by formidable peers, a duet with Tyner, a sax battle with Branford Marsalis, a recording with Tommy Flanagan and Jack DeJohnette, or playing without a band, as on the solo album from 1985, rather than fronting his often merely adequate working combo. Rollins's various retirements, reclusions, and reconsiderations could stand as symbolic of the whole era. Jazz was in a period of transition, of self-examination, of fragmentation into different schools. The music's modernist tradition, which Rollins epitomized, could no longer simply be taken for granted. Its assumptions about harmony, melody, rhythm, song structure, instrumentation, and perhaps even more about the social role of jazz music were constantly being questioned and increasingly found wanting by the more revolutionary musicians of the younger generation. Rollins's self-doubts were in many ways the same anxieties felt by his whole generation as it struggled to clear a path through this seeming pandemonium. Some looked for even more, for a transfiguring movement, the next new thing that would draw these fragments back together into a new coherence. Others less sanguine felt that there would be no more towering figures, titans of the caliber of Armstrong, Ellington, Goodman, or Parker, who could define a whole age, give impetus to an entire generation. Instead, jazz, it seemed, was condemned to, or was it blessed by, a pluralism in which next new things would come and go with amazing alacrity. Hard bop, post-bop, and soul jazz. In the fall of 1953, Max Roach moved to California to replace Shelly Mann as drummer with the Lighthouse All-Stars. This sideman stint lasted only a few months before promoter Gene Norman approached Roach about leading his own band at the California Club. Roach had occasionally taken top billing on the marquee in the past, but, by his own admission, had never pursued band leading with serious intent. The Norman proposal, however, spurred Roach to form a working quintet, one that not only would signal a turning point in the drummer's career, but, even more, would stand out as arguably the most influential jazz unit of the early 1950s. Roach invited the young trumpeter Clifford Brown to serve as co-leader. Brown had made his first recordings as a member of a rhythm and blues band only 2 years before, but was already being heralded by jazz insiders as a major talent. Born in Wilmington, Delaware, on October 30, 1930, Brown had played the bugle as a youngster and began trumpet lessons at age 12. His studies under the guidance of influential Wilmington jazz educator Robert Lowry emphasized ear training and basic trumpet technique. For a time, Brown attended Delaware State College as a math major, but by his late teens had decided on a career in jazz. A 1950 car accident, eerily foreshadowing his later death, sidelined Brown for almost a year, but in the interim he practiced the piano and expanded his knowledge of harmony. Brown's musical education, thus described, may seem haphazard, but the end result would have been the pride of Juilliard or Eastman. By the time of his emergence on the jazz scene in the mid-1950s, Brown had developed into a poised virtuoso. Perhaps he lacked Gillespie's range or Miles's inspired moodiness, but Brown's tone control, his fat sound, literally and metaphorically, given its source in Brown's chief inspiration, Fats Navarro, and flawless execution, stood out even in a jazz world filled with hot young trumpeters. A quarter of a century before Wynton Marsalis straddled the jazz and classical fields, Brown showed a similar precocious talent. Had he been so inclined, Brown could have flourished as an interpreter of the classical repertoire for the trumpet. As it was, he successfully married concert hall polish with the unbridled energy and creative impetus of modern jazz. Brown's work with Roach built on this same combination. The rougher edges of bebop were rounded off with finesse. Composition and arrangement were emphasized. Even when playing standards, the band would usually add an interesting twist to their interpretation, as in the shifting meters of I Get a Kick Out of You, Love is a Many-Splendored Thing, and What Am I Here For? In other instances, the unison heads typical of bop would be replaced with counterpoint or harmonized trumpet and saxophone lines. Increasingly, medium tempos were favored, but when pieces were played very fast, the performances still sounded controlled and collected. Even Roach's most impassioned drum solos reflected a concern with compositional structure and subtle dynamic effects. A lyrical strain was always evident to some degree, but never obscured the prevalent influence of the blues. The music collected these divergent streams into a coherent style, one that still showed an underlying allegiance to the bebop tradition, but was tempered by these other currents. In time, this style would come to be known as hard bop. The Brown Roach Quintet may not have been the originator of this sound. Elements of it can be heard, for example, on the August 1949 Bud Powell combo session for Blue Note, in some of the early 1950s West Coast jazz combos, including the Lighthouse All-Star Band Roach had just left, and in the work of two previous Brown employers, Tad Dameron and Art Blakey. Nor did Brown and Roach explore all the implications of this style of jazz, yet no group did more to give impetus to the hard bop idiom than this seminal quintet. Over the next decade, this style would gradually gain acceptance as the dominant mainstream sound of modern jazz. Even before leaving California, the Brown-Roach Quintet gave notice of its evolving approach to combo playing through a series of recordings made in Hollywood in early August 1954. Two Brown compositions destined to become jazz standards, Joy Spring and Da Hood, were given definitive performances graced by exceptional trumpet solos, as was Duke Jordan's Jordu. Delilah and Parisian Thoroughfare from the same sessions further highlighted the thoroughly arranged medium-tempo sound that would become widely imitated by later hard-bop ensembles. The following February, the band made additional recordings in New York, producing a number of memorable sides, including Sandu, a gospel-tinged piece that anticipated the later soul jazz side of the hard-bop movement. The Blues Walk, from the same period, showcased the more assertive side of the combo in a fiery performance climaxed by a dazzling series of chase choruses that pitted Brown and saxophonist Harold Land against one another. Soon after this recording, Land was replaced by the young Sonny Rollins, who was featured prominently on the band's 1956 recordings at Basin Street in New York. This period also witnessed the growing maturity of the quintet's pianist, Richie Powell, brother of Bud Powell, who contributed two compositions to the band's repertoire, Powell's Prances and Time, built on moody minor key themes, also destined to become a trademark of the hard bop style. The Brown Roach Quintet would last little more than 2 years. In June 1956, Brown was killed in a late-night automobile accident on the Pennsylvania Turnpike, along with pianist Powell and Powell's wife, Nancy. Brown's early demise was an ironic tragedy. He was one of the few major modern jazz musicians of the period who had avoided the indignities of substance abuse, who offered younger musicians a worthwhile role model, not only in his musicianship, but equally in his mature offstage demeanor. If any artist of this generation seemed destined for a long and productive jazz career, it was Clifford Brown. Yet he was dead at age 25. After a time, Roach regrouped, formed a quintet with trumpeter Kenny Dorham. In the wake of Dorham's departure, the drummer employed Booker Little, another trumpeter fated to die in his 20s. Although these were solid units, Roach's musical interests were increasingly taking him further afield from the hard bop style. For the most part, his strongest later works would look elsewhere for inspiration. Some would incorporate elements of free jazz, or explore different aspects of percussion music, or feature vocal work, often provided by Abby Lincoln, his wife from 1962 to 1970, or even embrace hip-hop. Some fans were shocked when he laid down tracks for rapper Fab Five Freddy, Could this be the same drummer who played with Byrd on 52nd Street? But anyone who had followed the career of this forward-looking percussionist knew that Roach took delight in expanding his own musical horizons. In other instances, he would put his rhythmic stamp on symphonic concerts, dance performances, gospel singing, or theater productions. Roach was also an early and ardent supporter of the civil rights movement, an advocacy that influenced his music. Two theories exist, he told an interviewer in the early 1970s. One is that art is for the sake of art, which is true. The other theory, which is also true, is that the artist is like a secretary. He keeps a record of his time, so to speak. My music tries to say how I really feel, and I hope it mirrors in some way how black people feel in the United States. It would be left to another modern jazz drummer to push the hard bop style to the next level. Born and raised in Pittsburgh, Art Blakey was already working in the local steel mills at age 14. Music provided an escape from this grueling day-to-day labor. In the evenings, Blakey would play piano at local venues. He had received a few lessons and showed a ready knack for music. When a young Errol Garner joined the band, Blakey switched to drums. Was there a lingering influence? As a percussionist, Blakey came to delight in sudden dynamic shifts and odd interjections, strikingly similar to Garner's idiosyncratic approach to the piano. In 1939, Blakey joined Fletcher Henderson and later worked with Mary Lou Williams before getting his first taste of modern jazz as drummer with Billy Eckstine's bop-oriented big band. Here, Blakey crossed paths with Gillespie, Parker, and a host of other forward-looking young musicians. Blakey revealed his affinity for the new music, forging a crisp, driving drum sound marked by a ferocious cymbal attack and punctuated unpredictably by swelling crescendos, brash rolls, and careening bombs. Blakey would later serve as a sideman on a number of important modern jazz recording sessions, including many of Thelonious Monk's finest early efforts. In the late 1940s, Blakey also led a large band and a smaller combo under the name Jazz Messengers. In the mid-1950s, he revived the name with a co-op quintet that featured pianist Horace Silver and a frontline of trumpeter Kenny Dorham and tenor saxophonist Hank Mobley. The Jazz Messengers, in various formats, would remain a major force in the jazz world for the next 30 years. In the process, it served also as a finishing school for up-and-coming jazz stars, many of whom would become important band leaders in their own right. Blakey's early efforts with Silver kept faithful to the bebop model, but in early 1955, the Messengers embarked on a new direction with their recording of The Preacher, a funky blues piece infused with elements of gospel music. This recording was immensely popular and widely imitated by later hard bop bands. The time was ripe for this return to the roots. Rhythm and blues and the gospel sounds of the sanctified church were starting to exert a powerful influence on American popular music. Singers as ostensibly different as Mahalia Jackson and Ray Charles were drawing on these same traditions in pursuing their sharply contrasting sacred and secular agendas. A new generation of Chicago blues artists, such as Muddy Waters and Howlin' Wolf, was similarly showing that traditional sounds could revitalize contemporary musical styles, and over the next few years, rock and roll would incorporate many of these same ingredients into a brusque, clangorous approach whose impact still reverberates. The jazz idiom also benefited from a return to these first principles of African-American music, at least for a time. Eventually, these funky and soulful sounds would become stale clichés in the jazz world, but for a period in the 1950s, their simpler attitudes, grooving two-steps, guttural backbeats, insistent melody lines drenched with blue notes, offered a healthy alternative to the more cerebral and aggressive strands of modern jazz. Silver and Blakey parted ways in 1956, with a drummer retaining the Jazz Messengers name for his band, while the pianist continued working with Mobley. Both Blakey and Silver relied on the hard bop sound in their combos, at times drawing on the down-home approach exemplified by The Preacher, but also refusing to be limited by it. Silver is often described as a key exponent of this funk-inflected style, yet his major compositions reveal, in fact, a refreshing diversity. These efforts include explorations of 6/8 rhythms, Senor Blues, Caribbean Latin hybrids, Song for My Father, medium tempo jaunts, Silver Serenade, free-spirited romps, Nutville, jazz waltzes, Pretty Eyes, and serene ballads, Peace. The unifying factor in these works is not so much Silver's funkiness, but rather the sharp focus of his musical vision. His sound is uncluttered. His melodies are succinct and memorable. The rhythms are propulsive without being overbearing. The obsession with virtuosity, so characteristic of bebop, is almost entirely absent and never missed. Art Blakey also worked to broaden the scope of hard bop, but with Blakey, much of the evolution in his music was driven by changes in the personnel of the Jazz Messengers. After separating from Silver, Blakey explored a wide range of possibilities. In 1957 alone, Blakey led sessions for 8 different record labels. Around this time, he renewed his musical relationship with Thelonious Monk, put together a percussion ensemble, led a 15-piece big band, spearheaded small combos that featured, among others, Jackie McLean, Johnny Griffin, and Donald Byrd, and with the Messengers, even gave the movement a flagship album with his Hard Bop release. For a period, he relied heavily on writers outside his band, enlisting the services of Duke Jordan, Mal Waldron, and Jimmy Heath. But in time, Blakey realized that his greatest successes came through nurturing the talents around him, as composers as well as players. The band's 1958 Blue Note release, Monin, mesmerized listeners with pianist Bobby Timmons' title track, which evoked church music and early African-American call-and-response refrains, as well as with Blues March and Along Came Betty by Messenger saxophonist Benny Golson. Monin remains one of the defining statements of the hard bop idiom, largely because of Blakey's willingness to let his sidemen take the lead in crafting the music. This unit of the Messengers also benefited from the gritty contributions of Lee Morgan, an impassioned improviser and, in many ways, the quintessential hard bop trumpeter. There was no brass player better able to extract the maximum amount of emotional energy from the bluesy minor key groove numbers that characterize the new sound. A Philadelphia native, Morgan had honed his skills in the working-class taverns and clubs of his hometown before joining Dizzy Gillespie's big band while still in his teens. Originally under the sway of Clifford Brown, Morgan came to develop a more personal style that mixed pungent short phrases with swinging longer lines and repeated figures. After leaving Blakey in 1961, Morgan recorded extensively as a leader for the Blue Note label and achieved a major success with his 1963 staccato funk outing, The Sidewinder, which eventually reached number 25 on the Billboard chart. Morgan spent much of the rest of his career trying to recreate this winning formula, although he was also capable of probing less jukebox-friendly artistic statements, such as Search for the New Land, an exquisite release recorded only a few weeks after The Sidewinder. One of the most spirited improvisers of his generation, Morgan was killed in 1972 between sets at a Lower East Side nightclub, shot with a pistol by a jealous lover. Benny Golson left the Messengers in 1959, prodded in part by Blakey's expressed distaste for the overly arranged drum parts on his charts, and formed the Jazz Tet, a combo that he led with Art Farmer. This ensemble, which for a brief period challenged the Messengers as the preeminent hard bop band of the day, lasted until 1962. Its work, superbly realized on the 1960 release Meet the Jazz Tet, relied heavily on Golson's writing. This music represented a different facet of the hard bop sound, less funky, more song-oriented, and in many ways modeled on the work of Golson's former employer, Tad Dameron. In this regard, Golson ranks among a handful of jazz composers, among them Jimmy Heath, Gigi Grice, Oliver Nelson, and Quincy Jones, whose stately and uncluttered style, reflecting firm roots in the swing era and stylistic affinities with a West Coast sound, has tended to be overshadowed by the more extroverted efforts that dominated the jazz world during these transition years. In time, many of these players gravitated to work as composer-arrangers, often outside the context of jazz music. After Golson's departure, Blakey hired tenorist Hank Mobley for a spell, recording a stirring nightclub performance under the title At the Jazz Corner of the World during this period. The addition of saxophonist Wayne Shorter later in the year initiated a new expansion in the scope of the band, which was solidified by the arrival of trumpeter Freddie Hubbard and pianist Cedar Walton in 1961. Shorter's elliptical manner of improvising and composing would come to exert a decisive influence on the Messengers, signaling a break with the rhythm and blues orientation of the Morgan-Timmons-Golson unit. A Newark, New Jersey native who studied fine arts during his adolescence and early teens, Shorter did not take up music until age 16. The work of his mature years would retain the painter's singular vision and sensitivity to subtle shadings. Indeed, many of Shorter's finest pieces could be described as tone poems evoking mental vistas. I was thinking of misty landscapes with wildflowers and strange, dimly seen shapes was Shorter's explanation of his masterful Speak No Evil recording, but this description would be equally appropriate in characterizing many of the saxophonist's other works. After high school, Shorter worked for a year in the Singer Sewing Machine Factory, saving the money he needed to attend New York University as a music major. While in the Army, Shorter continued to visit Manhattan on weekend passes, where he was befriended by John Coltrane, who would become a role model for the younger player. In time, Shorter would develop a deeply personal take on Coltrane's approach, using more space and adding a languorous, off-center manner of phrasing wholly his own. The advent of Freddie Hubbard to the band represented a less radical break with the past. Hubbard shared many similarities with his predecessor Morgan. Like Morgan, his trumpet playing was fiery, propelled by insistent rhythms, but also softened by a warm, full tone. Hubbard made greater use of the lyrical potential of the instrument, developing into a stellar ballad player, and offering a slightly more polished alternative to the sometimes rough-and-tumble Morgan. But he built his reputation on his nonpareil mastery of medium and fast tempos, where he stood out as an intimidating player you wouldn't want to battle at a jam session. An outstanding improviser with solid technique, Hubbard was an ideal choice for Blakey. Like many other Indianapolis-born jazz musicians, such as Wes Montgomery, Buddy Montgomery, Carl Perkins, and Leroy Vinegar, Hubbard showed an uncanny natural feel for the music. "How did he learn to play the trumpet? I just picked it up and started playing," he once explained to an interviewer. In 1958, Hubbard came to New York, where he gigged with Sonny Rollins, Quincy Jones, Philly Joe Jones, and J.J. Johnson before joining the Messengers. Hubbard fit comfortably into the band's hard bop approach, but his musical aspirations also took him on productive detours into other styles. Even before joining Blakey, he had participated on Ornette Coleman's Free Jazz Session, one of the most adventurous recording projects of the period, and he also shows up as sideman on albums by John Coltrane, Eric Dolphy, Randy Weston, and Oliver Nelson. His leader dates for Blue Note from the 1960s, including Hub Tones and Ready for Freddy, are outstanding examples of the hard bop style. His ensuing work for the CTI label tended to be a slicker product, incorporating some elements of the jazz rock fusion idiom, but the best of these projects, most notably Red Clay from 1970 and First Light from 1972, were effective vehicles for the trumpeter. The next decade found Hubbard vacillating between mainstream jazz and funk pop offerings of varying quality, some of them later repudiated by Hubbard himself. He returned to a more straight-ahead style in the 1980s, and although he still commanded respect as a major soloist, his accomplishments tended to be obscured by the rising stars of Woody Shaw, Wynton Marsalis, and Terence Blanchard. An injury to his lip in 1992, complicated by an infection, came close to ending his career. Hubbard continued to record and perform until his death in 2008, and though his late-period work is several steps below the masterful output of his earlier years, his legacy is secure as one of the most formidable trumpeters in the history of the music. With Hubbard and Shorter fronting the band, Blakey electrified audiences and produced a series of outstanding recordings, including Caravan, Kyoto, Three Blind Mice, and Ugetsu. Already a solid soloist, Shorter blossomed as a composer during his Blakey years. This is for Albert, Lester Left Town, Children of the Night, and other Shorter contributions bespoke a far greater sophistication than the rhythm and blues-influenced numbers that had dominated Blakey's late 1950s repertoire. Hubbard's extroverted improvisations served as an attractive foil for Shorter's moody lines, while the addition of trombonist Curtis Fuller complemented a potent horn triumvirate that gave depth to the Messenger sound. Until the saxophonist's departure to join the Miles Davis Quintet in September 1964, this edition of the Messengers stood out as the most captivating mainstream jazz combo of its day. Over 15 years would lapse before a Blakey band, then bolstered by the presence of Wynton and Branford Marsalis, would cause such a stir on the jazz scene. Horace Silver's mid-1960s combo might have challenged Blakey's supremacy in the hard bop idiom, if only it had lasted longer. Saxophonist Joe Henderson and trumpeter Woody Shaw, two of the most promising younger jazz talents of the day, fronted this edition of Silver's band. But unfortunately, only one studio project, the Cape Verdean Blues, captured this lineup in action. Henderson joined the group in 1964, a few months before Shaw's arrival in the band, and participated on Silver's notable Song for My Father date. This release marked a critical juncture in Silver's development as a composer, oddly inspired by a return to the Cape Verdean Portuguese musical roots of his father, a tradition Silver had long dismissed. My dad, through the years, had always said to me, "Why don't you take some of this Portuguese folk music and put it into jazz?" I never could see it. To me, it always seemed corny. But a trip to Rio de Janeiro, where the inviting sounds of bossa nova were in the air, inspired Silver to attempt just such a Cape Verdean jazz fusion. The resulting album became one of the biggest-selling releases in the history of the Blue Note label. Silver's follow-up project, the Cape Verdean Blues, built on this same foundation and featured, in addition to Henderson and Shaw, guest artist J.J. Johnson. Shaw had already performed and recorded with Eric Dolphy, whose influence was reflected in the trumpeter's use of wide intervals and his insistence on pushing harmonic structures to their breaking point. Shaw did this through the use of dissonances and melodic patterns that stretched the underlying chord changes and occasionally danced on the dividing line between tonal and atonal improvisation. Saxophonist Henderson was equally adept at this type of deconstructive phraseology. The title of his Blue Note release, In and Out, could serve as an apt description of Henderson's approach, in which his sandpaper sax lines insistently rub away at the hard bop structures undergirding the music. Shaw's later career was defined by deferred gratification amid many setbacks. The trumpeter did not receive widespread recognition in jazz circles until the late 1970s, when he made a series of celebrated recordings for the CBS label. Here, his sinewy melodic lines often superimposed jagged melodic fragments and modal stop-and-start phrases, spiced with a heavy dose of fourths on top of conventional chord structures. This was an increasingly faddish sound of the period. If intervals were fashions, the perfect fourth would have been the jazz equivalent of the leisure suit during the late 1970s. But no horn player employed this technique with more verve and sheer energy than Shaw. And no jazz trumpeter of the day seemed to have a brighter future. Yet by the early 1980s, Shaw's prominence was abruptly eclipsed by the arrival of Wynton Marsalis, who not only was quickly tagged as the new young lion of the trumpet, but also succeeded Shaw as the major focus of jazz promotion efforts at CBS Records. Still, other events conspired to derail Shaw's career: a broken relationship, depression, substance abuse, failing eyesight. A career that looked as though it would take off through the stratosphere now faltered, and finally came crashing down when Shaw lost his arm in a mysterious 1988 fall in the path of a New York subway train. This accident, if it was in fact an accident, was followed by a number of setbacks during the ensuing hospitalization, which led to the trumpeter's death from kidney failure 10 weeks later. Henderson's career, in contrast, revealed a gradual ascendancy, a pilgrim's progress marked by a steady accumulation of good works with few lapses. He recorded extensively for Blue Note in the mid-1960s, both as a leader, resulting in major efforts such as In and Out, Inner Urge, Mode for Joe, and The Kicker, and as a sideman. In the late 1960s and early 1970s, Henderson undertook a series of gigs with such high-profile bands as Miles Davis's, Herbie Hancock's, and Blood, Sweat, and Tears. During the same period, Henderson continued to evolve as a bandleader, a process documented on a number of solid recordings for the Milestone label. These were laudable achievements, but in retrospect, only a preamble to Henderson's widespread beatification as he approached his 50th birthday as a leading tenor of the times. This second phase in Henderson's career was kicked off by the magisterial State of the Tenor releases on Blue Note, recorded live with the trio at the Village Vanguard in 1985. Such an effort demanded, and survived, comparison with Rollins's classic trio project, same label, same club, same instruments, same multi-volume format, from 1957. In the 1990s, Henderson enjoyed the greatest critical success and record sales of his career, with a series of theme albums celebrating Billy Strayhorn, Miles Davis, and Antonio Carlos Jobim. Possessed of a powerful tenor voice, Henderson skillfully adapted the leading influences of his formative years into a vehement personal style. The Coltrane element is reflected most clearly on early Blue Note recordings, where Henderson is accompanied by McCoy Tyner and Elvin Jones. The Rollins influence comes more to the fore in his mid-career works, especially the various trio projects, and at times a wistful Getz-inspired warmth is evident on Henderson's 1990s projects, particularly when the tenorist interprets Strayhorn's Blood Count or Jobim's bossa nova compositions. Although he appeared on some of the biggest-selling recordings in the history of the Blue Note label, Song for My Father, The Sidewinder, Henderson never became mesmerized, as did many of his contemporaries, by the commercial potential of soul and funk-oriented music. In this regard, Henderson was something of an exception on the Blue Note roster. Alfred Lion, founder and manager of the Blue Note label, had originally objected to the release of Silver's The Preacher, the piece that established this crossover sound. But skyrocketing sales made Lion a true believer, and in time he was aggressively promoting an assortment of similar recordings. Other labels followed suit, propelling a whole cadre of musicians of greater and lesser talent to relative fame by jazz standards, supported by airplay, jukebox spins, and brisk record sales. Many critics dismissed this soul jazz style out of hand, but listeners responded with enthusiasm, boosting the careers of a new crop of jazz stars, including Jimmy Smith, Ramsey Lewis, Cannonball Adderley, Jimmy McGriff, Brother Jack McDuff, Eddie Harris, Ray Bryant, Richard Groove Holmes, Wes Montgomery, Les McCann, Lou Donaldson, Stanley Turrentine, and others. This style drew on a number of historical antecedents. The burgeoning rhythm and blues movement of the late 1940s and 1950s profoundly influenced the soul jazz players, as did, tracing the sound even farther back, the blues-drenched Kansas City and Texas tenor traditions. The crowd-pleasing antics of battling sax players, a jazz staple from the 1950s, celebrated by Gordon and Gray, Ammons and Stitt, Conn and Sims, even Coltrane and Robbins, also anticipated this later idiom. The successful relaunching of the battling tenors format during the heyday of soul jazz, under the capable hands of Eddie Lockjaw Davis and Johnny Griffin, was no coincidence. It demonstrated how close this time-honored approach was to the newer style. Bits and pieces of other African-American idioms were further tributaries flowing into this hybrid music, big band riffs, urban blues, call-and-response forms, and gospel music, among others. Soul jazz found its own voice most clearly in the electronically produced tones of the Hammond B3 organ. The B3's rough-and-ready, distorted sounds, in theory they were intended to emulate real instruments, but in practice were sui generis, captured the essence of the jazz sensibility, exciting audiences with their unabashed vigor, much as King Oliver's dirty cornet playing had done a generation earlier. Of course, the organ had appeared previously in jazz, mostly at the hands of keyboardists who usually played piano, such as Fats Waller and Count Basie, and it had always figured prominently in African-American sacred music. But the secularization of the organ in the jazz world did not gain momentum until the 1950s. Eddie Lockjaw Davis's 1951 recording with Bill Doggett was a pioneering effort in popularizing the tenor and organ combination. Around the same time, Wild Bill Davis established an organ trio that would also prove influential. But it was not until the arrival of Jimmy Smith on the jazz scene in the mid-1950s that the Hammond organ achieved wide recognition as a legitimate jazz instrument. In time, a legion of other keyboardists followed Smith's example and, by the close of the decade, the Hammond organ was firmly established as a mainstay of soul jazz. Smith had studied piano as a child and later learned to play the string bass. But around 1953, Wild Bill Davis's work inspired him to devote his energies to the organ. In 1955, Smith, accompanied only by guitar and drums, opened in Atlantic City and soon caused a sensation with his passionate performances, stretching out for 40 choruses on Sweet Georgia Brown, propelling the band with driving bass lines played on the foot pedals of the organ, exploiting the Hammond's full range of wails, buzzes, groans, shouts, honks, and screams. Within months, Smith was gigging in New York, where he caught the attention of Alfred Lion. Over the next several years, Smith would undertake dozens of sessions for Blue Note and establish himself as one of the label's biggest-selling artists. Jukebox singles and radio airplay helped build his career, but Smith frequently ignored the demands of these outlets, recording lengthy works that could never fit on the side of a 45 RPM record. Classic Smith performances such as The Champ and Back in the Chicken Shack might last 8 minutes or more, while Smith's The Sermon clocked in at 20 minutes and 11 seconds of gut-wrenching blues. Yet the records sold despite, or perhaps because of, their length. The unrelenting intensity and powerful drive of the music were hypnotic, a soul jazz anticipation of John Coltrane's marathon performances, which audiences would find similarly compelling a few years later. By the late 1950s and early 1960s, a host of other jazz organists were plowing the same field, promoting a sound that would soon be in danger of becoming a stale cliché. Before long, sales of tenor and organ trio records would plummet, and eventually the Hammond B3 would be taken off the market, replaced in the public's imagination by the more versatile but perhaps colder sounds of synthesized music. But during these glory years of the Hammond B3, audiences could enjoy the work of Jimmy McGriff, Brother Jack McDuff, Shirley Scott, Richard Groove Holmes, Johnny Hammond Smith, Charles Erland, and other masters of the instrument. Without the sterling example of Larry Young, one might have thought that the possibilities of the Hammond organ had been exhausted by the mid-1960s. Although Young was well-schooled in the soul jazz idiom, he came to reject the narrow funk and blues orientation of most Hammond players. Over the next several years, Young would record a series of important releases for Blue Note that incorporated modal phrasing and denser harmonies and drew inspiration from John Coltrane, McCoy Tyner, free jazz, even hard rock. He would later record with Miles Davis on the influential Bitches Brew release, as well as with fellow Davis sidemen John McLaughlin and Tony Williams. His 1970s work with them, recorded under the band name Lifetime, was one of the most promising developments of the jazz rock fusion movement, although it never achieved the commercial success that many lesser fusion bands enjoyed. This most forward-looking exponent of the Hammond organ, perhaps its final major innovator, was only 38 years old when he died in 1978, the victim of an improperly treated stomach ailment. The jazz organ would never again match the level of popularity it achieved during the soul jazz years, yet, strange to say, the many advances in synthesizer and programming technology failed to make this comparatively primitive instrument obsolete. Even in the new millennium, the organ is the most popular jazz keyboard outside of the piano, attracting a cadre of dedicated fans and world-class exponents. The glory days of the Hammond B3 were all but over by the time Joey DeFrancesco was born in 1971. But he has completely assimilated the tradition of Jimmy Smith and other predecessors and has introduced new generations of fans to its persuasive sounds via relentless touring, amounting to around 200 nights on the road in any given year, and more than 24 recordings as a leader. DeFrancesco has done more than anyone to keep the organ in a prominent position in the jazz world during the new millennium, but he is far from a lone evangelist. A talented cohort of performers, including Gary Versace, Sam Yahel, and John Medeski, has expanded the vocabulary and expressive range of the instrument and moved it beyond the soul jazz clichés of the past. The electric guitar also played a key role in the soul jazz idiom, sometimes working in tandem with the Hammond organ. This too would quickly become a hackneyed sound, although major players such as Kenny Burrell and Grant Green proved capable of important recordings that transcended the form's limitations. Burrell's 1963 Midnight Blue is a classic hard bop release, while his Guitar Forms project with Gil Evans from the following year, less easy to categorize, is a major milestone by almost any measure. Grant Green's Matador, recorded in 1964 but not released for 15 years, finds the bandleader in the inspirational company of Elvin Jones and McCoy Tyner, then anchoring John Coltrane's rhythm section, while Green's collaborations with pianist Sonny Clarke from the early 1960s represent one of the most inspired pairings of piano and guitar in the hard bop oeuvre. Yet of this generation of guitarists, Wes Montgomery stood out as the most skillful in combining commercial appeal with jazz street cred. An incisive soloist with an unsurpassed gift for melodic improvisation, Montgomery was an ideal candidate for crossover success as a pop jazz star. His recordings cover a wide gamut, from straight ahead to soul jazz to mood music, but his singular talent gave even the most blatantly commercial efforts a stamp of artistry. Born in Indianapolis in 1923, Wes was a member of a musical family that also included bassist Monk Montgomery and pianist vibraphonist Buddy Montgomery. Despite a late start, he did not begin playing the guitar until he was almost 20 years old, and a lack of formal training, Wes quickly developed into a distinctive stylist and a quirky but exquisite improviser. He never made much traction in learning to read music or even chord symbols, but this hardly hindered his progress. Within months, Wes was working on gigs with his brothers and other local musicians. A reluctant traveler, Montgomery went on the road with Lionel Hampton in the late 1940s, but returned to Indianapolis in 1950, where he raised a family, worked by day in a radio factory, and performed at night. Montgomery's career might well have ended in obscurity in this setting. However, an enthusiastic recommendation by Cannonball Adderley led to the Riverside label signing Montgomery in 1959. Under the direction of producer Orrin Keepnews, Montgomery recorded extensively over the next several years in jazz combo settings with top-quality sidemen, creating a number of milestone performances including 4-on-6, West Coast Blues, and Bésame Mucho. A modest man with recurring doubts about his self-taught technique, Montgomery ultimately made a virtue out of his unconventional methods of playing the guitar. Whether through necessity or choice, he pared down the guitar vocabulary of the bebop years, replacing the convoluted note-filled phrases of the post-Christian period with taut, uncluttered solos. Using his thumb instead of a pick, Montgomery produced a vibrant singing tone on the instrument, reinforced by his frequent use of octave melody lines. Montgomery's later work, produced by Creed Taylor, found his playing increasingly featured in lackluster settings with syrupy strings. By the time of his final projects with the A&M label, Montgomery was relegated to playing cover versions of Beatles songs and other pop rock tunes. But even these recordings were not without their moments, and they had at least the benefit of broadening Montgomery's audience. Indeed, Montgomery's A Day in the Life release became the biggest-selling jazz record of 1967. The guitarist did not live long enough to enjoy the full benefits of this success. The following year, he succumbed to a heart attack at age 45. As Montgomery's late career switch to a more pop-rock-oriented format should make clear, the soul jazz idiom was showing its age by the late 1960s. For many years, the soul jazz players had managed to maintain a solid following among the black working class. But other musical styles were now on the rise, usurping this audience. The Motown sound, jazz rock fusion, and other related idioms reflected a slicker, more contemporary facet of African-American music. The 1970s saw the completion of this trend, with the urban market for soul jazz almost completely displaced by funk, disco, reggae, soul, and rock. Jazz devotees sometimes groused that this shift reflected a watering down of standards in black popular music. To some degree, this may have been true, but what these critics missed was that the most talented artists in these new styles, Stevie Wonder, Jimi Hendrix, Bob Marley, James Brown, Marvin Gaye, Sly Stone, Minnie Riperton, Bill Withers, Earth, Wind & Fire, and others, were offering listeners a body of music that was, for the most part, fresher and more creative than the increasingly predictable soul jazz regurgitations of gut bucket blues and organ and tenor groove tunes. On a broader level, the entire hard bop movement was similarly in danger of running out of steam. By 1960, hard bop, in the opinion of historian James Lincoln Collier, had come to a dead end. Amiri Baraka, viewing the music from a much different perspective than Collier, reached essentially the same conclusion in his book, Blues People. Hard bop, sagging under its own weight, had just about destroyed itself by the close of the 1950s. It had become a self-conscious celebration of cliché and an actual debilitation of the most impressive ideas to come out of bebop. The ideological distance between these two critics can be gauged by the fact that Collier follows his denunciation of hard bop by praising the superiority of the Dixieland revival, while Jones's critique is in the context of a pay-on to free jazz. The fact that they could agree on the degraded state of hard bop post-1960 is revealing. There may have been debates about the line of succession, but many concurred that the old king was dead. Yet both critics go too far. As we have seen, Blakey and Silver, the two main protagonists in the birth of hard bop, led some of their finest bands during the 1960s. Blue Note, the label most responsible for promoting the style, refused to be limited by their customers' preconceived notions about the so-called Blue Note sound. During this decade, the label released iconoclastic projects such as Cecil Taylor's Unit Structures, Eric Dolphy's Out to Lunch, and Ornette Coleman's Love Call. Most listeners would have had trouble linking these projects to the traditional Blakey Silver approach, but other, less radical Blue Note releases showed that there could be a meeting point between hard bop and the avant-garde. Important projects such as Andrew Hill's Point of Departure, Bobby Hutcherson's Dialogue, and Jackie McLean's Let Freedom Ring were anything but drab repetitions of old hard bop formulas. A host of other Blue Note projects by Herbie Hancock, Joe Henderson, Lee Morgan, Wayne Shorter, Sam Rivers, and others also made it clear that this idiom was far from exhausted. Anyone who doubted that hard bop stylings could adapt and evolve during the 1960s need merely listen to pianist Andrew Hill's 1960s recordings for Blue Note. Few fans did so at the time, and it is testimony to the label's commitment to this artist that Blue Note continued to release new music by the pianist throughout the decade, despite his poor sales. Hill, born in Chicago in 1931, drew on a wide range of influences at an early age in his development, studying with mentors as diverse as Bill Russo and Paul Hindemith, and gigging with beboppers and rhythm and blues bands. Hill's mature work was a strange amalgamation, prickly and cerebral by turns, and not targeted at crossover airplay like so many other Blue Note releases from the period. At the time, his music was too inside to be embraced by the avant-garde, but too difficult to appeal to most soul jazz and hard bop fans. Yet history has validated his importance, his hybrid of experimentalism and formalism, dissonance and tonality, above all his focus on pushing at the limits of musical structures while still respecting their value, have made Hill an influential role model for many later pianists. At the time of Hill's death in 2007, one could hear echoes of his work in leading younger generation artists such as Jason Moran, Vijay Iyer, and Matthew Shipp. Two preeminent jazz band leaders of the era, Charles Mingus and Miles Davis, also drew inspiration from the hard bop style, albeit transforming it in the process. Mingus's music during this period is especially interesting when viewed from the perspective of hard bop. He drew heavily on the same ingredients that had proven successful for Blakey and Silver, an appreciation for African-American roots music such as gospel and blues, a zest for hard swinging, often funky playing, a rigorous schooling in the bebop idiom, a renewed emphasis on formalism and the possibilities of jazz composition, and a determination to exploit the full expressive range of the traditional horns plus rhythm jazz combo. Despite these similarities, few critics of the period saw Mingus as a part of the hard bop school. Yet his mature musical explorations rarely ventured far afield from this ethos. Had Mingus recorded for Blue Note and drawn on the services of other musicians affiliated with that label, these links would have been more evident. As it stands, he is typically seen as a musician who defies category, more a gadfly, skilled at disrupting hegemonies rather than supporting the current trends in play. Mingus is remembered as a progressive who never really embraced the freedom principle and a traditionalist who constantly tinkered with and subverted the legacies of the past. Yet for all these contradictions, his oeuvre has stood the test of time and has grown in influence while others, more easy to pigeonhole, have faded from view. This convergence of conflicting influences was a product of Mingus's development as a musician. His early biography is the history of a heterogeneous series of allegiances to a variety of styles. Known as a steadfast advocate of modern jazz, Mingus had actually been late to the party. Under the sway of Ellington, the younger Mingus had denounced bebop, going so far as to claim that his friend Buddy Collette could play as well as Byrd. But when he changed his mind, he did so, in typical Mingus fashion, with a vengeance. "Charles Mingus loves Byrd, man," Miles Davis later recalled, "almost like I have never seen nobody love." Later Mingus passed through a phase where cool jazz was a predominant influence, and even aligned himself for a time with the Tristano school. His relationship with the Free Players was even more complex, with Mingus vacillating from disdain to extravagant praise. These various strata were underpinned by Mingus's early study of classical music, diligent practice on the cello, and rapt listening to Bach, Beethoven, Debussy, Ravel, and Strauss, among others. This was an odd musical house of cards, in which Strauss's Death and Transfiguration and the Duke's East St. Louis Toodaloo were precariously balanced against one another. The miracle of Mingus's music was that he could develop a coherent and moving personal style out of this hodgepodge of influences. A generation later, such eclecticism, the style without a style, would increasingly become the norm in the jazz world. Jazz players would aspire to be historians, using the bandstand as a lectern, the bells of their horns quoting a series of textbook examples. Alas, only a fine line often separates these histories from mere histrionics. Hearing many latter-day players struggle to tie together the various strands, most often serving only awkwardly to regurgitate the past, makes it all the more clear how extraordinary was Mingus's ability to ascend and descend through the various roots and branches of the jazz family tree. Then again, Mingus had the advantage of learning these styles firsthand. He was among a select group who could boast of having worked as sideman for Armstrong, Ellington, and Parker, the three towering giants of the first half century of jazz, not to mention having served alongside Tatum and Powell, Norvo and Hampton, Dolphy and Getz, Eldridge and Gillespie. This was jazz history of a different sort, imbibed directly and not learned in a school or from a recording. Perhaps because of this training, perhaps merely due to his sheer force of personality, Mingus managed not only to embrace a world of music, but to engulf it in an overpowering bear hug. Despite these many linkages to jazz history, his music sounded neither derivative nor imitative. Whether playing a down-home blues, a silky ballad, an abstract tone poem, a New Orleans two-step, or a freewheeling jam, his work was immediately identifiable, bearing the unique imprimatur of Charles Mingus. A few months after his birth in Nogales, Arizona, on April 22, 1922, Charles Mingus lost his mother Harriet to myocarditis, an inflammation of the heart. The child was raised mostly in the Watts neighborhood of Los Angeles by